You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lin Chang. Dr. Chang is the co-director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience and vice chief of the Vache and Tamara Manoukian Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lin Chang, and welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, or IBS. Today, we'll be discussing a few topics, including the history of IBS, the gut-brain axis, the biopsychosocial approach, and the role of early life adversity and stress with our guest, Dr. Doug Drossman. Dr. Drossman is currently Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, where he was on staff from 1977 through 2011. He was founder and co-director of the UNC Center for Functional Gastrointestinal and Motility Disorders, is President Emeritus and Chief Executive Officer of the Rome Foundation and President of Drossman Center for the Education and Practice of Biopsychosocial Care. Welcome to In Discussion.
Thank you, Lynn. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's really an honor to speak with you today because we've been colleagues for many years. You're a mentor of mine, so it's really a pleasure. I wanted to start off the discussion by you telling us about yourself and how you became interested in IBS.
Sure, thank you. Well, I'm married. I have two children and 10 grandchildren. And in my work world, I've always been interested in medicine and psychiatry or psychosocial factors. In fact, I didn't even know if I wanted to go into medicine or GI. And I decided to go into medicine and then GI rather than psychiatry, I'm sorry, because I wanted to treat patients. But I always had that interest. And what happened was that after my medical training, I went into a psychosomatic program with George Engel, who coined the term biopsychosocial model. So from the very beginning of my training, I was integrating medicine and psychiatry or psychosomatic medicine. So that kind of got me interested in the disorders of gut-brain interaction. And I think the big thing happened in 77 when I was a fellow, Don Powell, who was my division chief, got a request to do a review for a series that was coming out of the Journal of Gastroenterology. He asked me if I'd do it with him, and I said, yeah, let's do irritable bowel syndrome, which had really not been out there that much. So we did an article which combined the psychologic, the motility, and the treatment aspects, and that became very popular, and I think that's where I first got started.
Well, that's great. You really are one of the pioneers in the field of IBS. Now, our understanding of IBS has evolved over the years, and you've been really present to see that evolution over time. Can you describe how IBS was perceived in the past and how it's changed over time up to the present day?
Sure. Well, before the 20th century, the entity didn't exist as a diagnosis as much as a collection of symptoms. In fact, I remember in reviewing this that in the 1840s, there was a doctor named Cummings who may have been the first description. He said, these are patients who can have diarrhea and constipation at the same time. How is that imaginable? And that was maybe one of the earlier ones. But they were a collection of symptoms. And then beginning around the 1940s, the late 1940s, there were physiologists from New York and Cincinnati and other places had started to do physiology research. They were looking at motility. They would put tubes down. They would measure pressures. And this got into the idea of motility. One of my mentors was Tom Almy, who did research early on in the late 40s and early 50s. He even did an experiment with medical students where he put a sigmoidoscope in the medical student's colon and pretended that he saw a cancer while he was observing the pressure generated in this rectosigmoid. So that was, of course, before IRB, but then it got more sophisticated. And so from the 40s until the 80s, physiology really dominated it. And it was thought, certainly diarrhea and constipation was caused by physiologic motility dysfunction. But then looking at symptoms like pain and nausea, they tried to explain it based on these pressure-generated waves, but they couldn't explain it. Now, I think a paradigm shift happened in 1990. Two things happened. One was the Rome Foundation, which was just starting, developed diagnostic criteria which allowed people to have consistency in research so that patients could be studied around the world and they would be the same group phenotypically. In addition to that, work was being done on visceral hypersensitivity, which was different than motility. So Bill Whitehead did it in the bowel, Joel Richter did it in the esophagus. So there was now evidence that independent of motility, you could generate hypersensitivity where distension of the bowel would lead to higher levels of pain reporting by these patients. And I think those two factors led to this, let's say, tension between physiologic explanations and the what we later called symptom-based diagnoses using Rome criteria or functional GI disorders. And the good thing about that is by using the criteria, it really opened the door to more research. And so if you trace the last, 30 years since 1990, what you're seeing are less in the way of physiology to explain everything, but to be a component. But what we see more is the microbiome, gut mucosal immune function, brain-gut interactions, and the like.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point that over time, there's been different pathophysiologic mechanisms attributed to IBS, one of them being motility, which we are including motility in understanding IBS, but it's much more than that. It's a complex condition. So, you know, IBS has been redefined, and you led this way, from a functional gastrointestinal disorder to a disorder of gut-brain interactions, and scientific evidence has supported that redefinition. How would you describe the brain-gut axis to patients and clinicians? And also, what do you find are the most important aspects of brain-gut axis that are applicable to patient care?
I should say that one reason that we changed the term from functional GI to disorder of gut-brain interaction is because we had learned from our surveys of the AGA and among talking to patients that it's a very stigmatizing term because it often leads to the implication that there's nothing being found, or that it must be psychiatric. The real entity of functional GI was meant to be disorder of function, but it never came across that way. So with the science that was evolving in the 90s to the 2000s and now, we're talking about the brain-gut axis. And I say to the patients that the brain and the gut are in constant communication to regulate bowel functioning, pain, motility, sensations like nausea and the like. And this is based on a hardwired connection between the gut and the brain. The brain and the gut don't work independently in terms of these sensations. I'll explain that an example of the brain-gut axis would be if you're running a race and you sprain your ankle, that you may not feel the pain because the attention on the race is downregulating or blocking the signals coming from your foot. Or if you see something like a car accident, you might get nauseated and throw up. So it's the brain and the gut that are dysregulated. And the good part about this dysregulation is that it opens the door to treatment, which can open up looking at neuromodulators, brain-gut behavioral treatments, in addition to peripheral neuromodulators, treating the gut alone. So I tell them that it's a logical explanation for their symptoms because there's no structural findings. These patients are struggling with, what do I have? And nobody can really tell them because the studies are negative from the dualistic model. And then I can say that the last 20 or 30 years have led to an explosion of understanding of these brain-gut dysregulation and treatments to regulate them. So in a sense, I'm giving them a greater sense of understanding and hope by using the brain-gut axis.
Yeah, you know, I think that even though we intrinsically know that symptoms can be generated by physiologic changes within our body or within the brain-gut axis, I think sometimes we all tend to think a little more concretely where we're expecting to see a structural or anatomic abnormality, but you can have a physiologic abnormality that is contributing to the symptoms. I do agree that it's important to discuss that with your patients and teach that in, you know, to clinicians. You did mention about having acute stimulus and that you don't feel the pain, but the brain is also activating these descending pain inhibitory pathways to dampen that at that moment. But with a chronic stimulus, then the pain gets actually enhanced. And that's really due to that bi-directional two-way highway between the brain and the gut. And it's really important.
Yeah, you can have in the gut visceral hypersensitivity where even normal regulatory activity could be signaled and be experienced by the brain. And in addition to that, you get a failure of the brain to downregulate those signals. So you get a double dose in patients with their pain.
Yeah, I think a good example of that and something that you're very familiar with is post-infection IBS, where patients have no IBS symptoms. They get an infection, so they clearly have some insult to the gastrointestinal tract, but the infection goes away, but then they get these chronic symptoms of IBS, and that's really due to the dysregulation of the brain-gut axis. But it really, the insult starts in the gut.
It starts in the gut. You can get what, you know, some people call leaky gut, which is a media term, but we're talking about a loss of mucosal integrity. So you can get transmigration of products that can sensitize the nerves. And secondarily, in a setting of stress, as with post-infection IBS, whether it could be, we've done work with war veterans, so deployment in a war zone, getting an infection can give them post-infection because the stress is also affecting that permeability, the failure to block the signals coming up.
Yeah, the role of stress is really important that we're going to get to. I wanted to talk first about the biopsychosocial model that you brought into this field. And you mentioned about the ALMI study where you can get a distressing type of experience and it could change the physiology of your gut. Can you describe the biopsychosocial model as it pertains to IBS and how you use this approach in taking care of patients?
Sure. Well, the biopsychosocial model, I was very fortunate to have my mentor write the seminal publication in Science in 1977 when I was a GI fellow, and I carried it through my whole career. And what he's doing is merely saying real life, that illness and disease is not the product of biologic dysfunction alone, but there have to be other factors, including the brain-gut axis or psychosocial factors, which can affect the clinical expression, even the causation of the condition in many different ways. And it kind of replaces the mind-body dualistic model because, as we're talking about, you don't see something structural, but there must be something there. And the biopsychosocial model brings that understanding, the psychologic factors, which are part of the way patients experience illness. And so symptoms of pain or motility are modified by psychosocial factors. As I said before, this opens the door to better treatments.
That's really important that we not recognize just the symptoms, but we pay attention to how the patient's managing their symptoms. Yeah. What are environmental factors that can impact, you know, how well they're doing or how they're managing their symptoms? So how do you actually apply that when you're seeing a patient? Are you thinking about all the different factors, biologic, physiologic, psychosocial, that play a role in that patient's presentation? And do you describe that to the patient? Like, how do you actually put it in play when you're taking care of patients?
Well, getting a history, and this will get into maybe some of the work on communication, but in getting the history, I allow the patient to speak because they tell the story. That's what Osler said, right? And I don't interrupt, and I give them the time. And although people worry about that, it usually only takes 2 or 3 minutes before they stop, most patients. But I'm gathering information because patients tell their story in a psychosocial context. And if they're saying to me, you know, I got my pain while driving to the office, most people might say, okay, then what happened? Or tell me about the pain. But I might say, in the context of saying that, what type of work do you do? And was there anything going on at the office at the time? So I use the time where they bring up something else of a psychosocial to have them elaborate on it. Then I bring them back to the story because you take the history through what's called a narrative thread. It's from beginning to end of, say, their symptom of pain. So I asked them to elaborate that, okay, so you were saying it was on the way to the office. What happened? That's the first thing I do. I also try to get certain questions answered, even on the first visit. What brought you here today? What do you think is going on? Their illness schema. That's a way to get psychosocial information. And how can I be helpful to you? These are the kind of questions that are helpful in understanding the psychosocial context of what's going on. So I work on integrating that information. And, you know, if I were to find out that the illness began on the anniversary of the father's death from esophageal cancer, and they're talking about chest pain, I can bring them back to that story and say, you know, it's really interesting that it happened on an anniversary. Maybe you were thinking about that at that time. And that helps me decide how attuned the patient is to understanding that issue. Now, if they were to say, well, that has nothing to do with me, then I take that as data and I won't pursue it, but I'll keep it in the back of my mind. But if they say, oh yeah, that might make a difference, that opens the door later to talking about brain-gut therapies. So I'm constantly gathering information, integrating it, and then trying to play it back to the patient to see their response. And that really is the biopsychosocial model, right?
Yeah, and that's the approach also I take. I think it's really important to listen to the patient and really just convey it back to them. But sometimes it helps to bring the whole story together from a biopsychosocial standpoint to them. Because a lot of times they have the bits and pieces, but not really collected together.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, just remember medical school, history of this present illness, past medical history, social factors, they're totally different. And we tend to partition it in medical school, and we have to reverse that. We have to let the patient, we call it patient-centered care, tell their story, and we're the experts that put it all together and put it back to them.
Well, I'm a fellowship training program director at UCLA, and I've noticed that when fellows are training and they're taking care of inpatients and there's a GI bleed, the questions are often like checklist because you're trying to get the history and determine the urgency. But the outpatient care is different. You have to have a different thought process and framework of how you ask questions, because it isn't so difficult to make the diagnosis of IBS, I feel, if you have some experience on our knowledge of it. But it's really determining all the factors that are involved that play a role in that patient's, you know, presentation and their understanding of how they manage their symptoms. Well, I want to get to the role of stressful life events in childhood or adulthood, such as abuse. You've studied this a lot. Can you elaborate on the association of chronic stress and the development of IBS and also the role of stress for symptom flares?
Well, as you know, I've been interested in medicine and psychiatry or psychosomatic medicine or biopsychosocial medicine. So that really was the beginning of my research too. I was interested in looking at the role of stress and psychosocial factors. We're talking the 1980s now, right after I finished my fellowship. And one of the questions that struck me when we were looking at IBS was that people looked at it in two ways. Again, due to that physiology, biopsychosocial split, that patients with IBS were stressed because they had severe motility disturbance, and that's why they had it. And the other camp was saying, these are psychiatric disorders like somatization. So I went ahead to try to study that by creating this model of looking at people with IBS who were patients, people who weren't patients, and people who were healthy. And I looked at them medically, physiologically, in terms of sensation threshold with Bill Whitehead, and also in terms of their psychosocial parameters. And what we found was the psychologic distress or disturbance was greater in the patients than they were in people with IBS who didn't go to the doctor. And the ones who didn't go to the doctor would note statistically not different from normals. So what that began to tell me is that healthcare seeking was a factor that was associated with more of those who were healthcare seekers were more psychologic difficulties or distress. And as the symptoms became more severe, there was more psychologic disturbance. So I saw it as an interacting factor between the brain and the gut, that the stressful factors can enable the phenotypic expression of their symptoms. So that was the first part. Because of Engel's training and of me with interviewing, I started to do kind of more attention to listening to the patients. And then I found I'm looking at my GI clinic and everybody coming to me had a history of trauma and abuse. I didn't understand that. So the first thing we did was to do a survey of the GI clinic, not just my clinic, which was getting all the IBS people, but the whole GI clinic. And we gave them a survey with Jane Lessamine, who was a colleague of mine, on abuse. And then we also got an NIH grant to study it in more detail with interviews. And the bottom line is, what we found was that about 50% of the women going to the GI clinic had a history of ongoing or early sexual or physical abuse. And that led us to get the grant. And then with the further work of the grant, we began to see that this had significant impact on health status, their psychologic scores, their quality of life, their healthcare utilization, even the propensity to have surgery. A patient with abuse and IBS were more likely to get surgery than patients with just IBS, and that surgery was not necessarily indicated. We then looked at brain imaging and found that the pain scores to rectal distension was higher and the sensitivity of the rectal distension was less in those with abuse who had IBS and those who didn't have IBS. And then I think the greatest part about that is that there's been even greater elaboration of these early factors. Lynn, you've done work with deprivation and many other factors, so it's been really exciting to see what's carried on since my work in the 90s.
Yeah, I find that studying the role of early life adversity, stress is so relevant to the patients. And it isn't just abuse. It could be a general adversity like mental illness in the household, you know, growing up. But I wanted to get to your role as a leader in the patient-provider relationship. I know that's something you're very passionate about. It's very valuable. Can you address the importance of good communication to optimize the patient-provider relationship?
The thing that makes my situation very unique is from the very moment I started working in GI after meeting with Engel, I was interested in the history. In fact, it's interesting that when I was a fellow doing endoscopy in the days when we did three or four a day, we had time to talk to the patients. And I would get histories and I would try to predict who would have the ulcer or IBD or who would have a normal study with pretty good accuracy because I was getting the psychosocial data. So I made that a part of my career in teaching when I was giving grand rounds or when I was doing visiting professorship. I always integrated it. And I think that if we look at the modern times, what we've learned now, and I think a pivotal moment, Lynn, was the paper you and I did and several others last year where we did an evidence-based review to show that good communication skills or the training of communication skills was predictive of reduction of health outcomes, reduction in symptoms, increased satisfaction of the doctor and the patient, reduced procedures, and even reduction in healthcare costs. So we have the science now to justify it. So the passion now comes because I've been a firm believer in collaborative care, patient-centered care. I work with Johanna Ruddy, who was a patient and is a patient advocate, and we do communication skills workshops to talk about the value of the patient. And in fact, just this weekend, we're going to do a train-the-trainer session with some key leaders in the field, teaching them how to run workshops and how to improve their skills. So I think it's helped me to be a good teacher, to try to tell people what it's really like, because it's really very valuable to watch them use these skills and then come back to me and said, you know, I saw this patient, I did it this way, and now they're better, and I feel really good about it.
Yeah, well, I've definitely benefited from learning from you. My whole approach of taking care of patients really changed after I started seeing patients with you many years ago. So thank you for that. So we're about out of time, but is there any key message of IBS that you'd like to convey to the audience?
Well, if the audience are gastroenterologists, I would say that IBS and the other DGBIs are the most challenging, exciting, and enjoyable areas in gastroenterology. I don't want to demean other specialties, well, what more can you do for GERD? There are things you can do, but I think here we're building on the knowledge and creating new treatments. Basic and translational research in the microbiome, brain-gut interactions. And then I think the treatments, looking at neuromodulators, brain-gut treatments, we didn't talk much about that. And the discovery of new treatments for GI symptoms, because neuromodulators involve the gut with new agents on the enteric nervous system and the brain. And I think finally, we're opening up the opportunities to help patients who have never felt help before. We are dealing with a cohort that are dissatisfied with their care, and we can do something about it.
Yeah, well, those are all wonderful comments. I mean, this has been a great foundation for our series on IBS. This is our first one. So today we've had Dr. Doug Drossman discussing the history of IBS, the brain-gut axis, the biopsychosocial approach, and the role of stress in early life adversity and the patient-provider relationship. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Lynn Chang for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Irritable Bowel Syndrome podcast series with our host, Dr. Lynn Chang. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on irritable bowel syndrome.